The former Liberal Democrat leader Sir Vince Cable has called on the police to look into claims that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor leaked sensitive information to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein while he was a UK trade envoy. Sir Vince, who was business secretary at the time, said the alleged behaviour, reported in the Mail on Sunday, was totally unacceptable. Mr Mountbatten Windsor has previously denied any wrongdoing. The Labour MP, Rachel Maskell, says it's clear he's been conservative with the truth.
Now there are questions over his relationship as the trade envoy. We need to get to the bottom as somebody in a key position as to what conversations took place. Was there a breach of the confidence which is put in trade envoys?
Iran says it's ready to consider compromises in order to reach a deal with the United States over its nuclear programme. The country's Deputy Foreign Minister Majid Takht Ravanchi told the BBC that if America was sincere, an agreement could be reached. A second round of talks will be held in Geneva next week. President Trump has threatened strikes against Iran if a deal can't be struck, with the US military building up its presence in the region. Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper said further sanctions could be imposed on Russia after new tests on the body of the opposition leader Alexei Navalny showed he was poisoned in prison 2 years ago. Russia said the findings were an attempt to distract from the West's problems. Health officials in Gaza say at least 9 people have been killed in Israeli airstrikes in the territory overnight. They said at least 4 Palestinians died in an encampment for displaced families. Israel's military said they were responding to ceasefire violations by Hamas. A leading paediatrician says children have been weaponised by both sides of a toxic debate about transgender rights. Dr Hilary Cass, who led a major review of NHS child gender services in England, also told the BBC some children might not have pursued medical treatments if they'd taken more time before making the decision. A measles outbreak in schools in North London's left several children needing hospital treatment. The UK Health Security Agency says about a third of the cases confirmed so far this year in England have been in Enfield. And the weather breezy and unsettled this afternoon with outbreaks of rain, sleet and snow moving in from the west. That's the BBC News at 2 minutes past 12. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Philippa Gregory has been called the Queen of Historical Fiction. The English Royal Court has inspired many of her best-selling titles, and she's written 16 novels about the Plantagenets and the Tudors. One of them, The Other Boleyn Girl, became a BBC television drama and a Hollywood movie, starring Scarlett Johansson and Natalie Portman. This success probably surprised her A-level teachers. She said she found history insanely boring at school, but her passion was fired at university. She's also written non-fiction, notably seeking the stories of what she calls normal women over 900 years. More recently, she's returned to the Tudors with a novel called Boleyn Traitor, focusing on the intrigue surrounding Anne's sister-in-law, Jane. Philippa, you brought us music by Mozart, Philip Glass, Scott Joplin, but I think you're going to start with a mazurka from Coppelia.
Well, it's a lovely piece to start anything with. It's incredibly danceable. I defy anybody not to have a little, you know, soft shoe shuffle at the very least. I find it very, very inspiring, very, very enchanting. And it's also from the point of view of the ballet watcher, as I was from a very little girl, is it sort of the curtain goes up and you're in this magical world of colour and movement, as magical as anything you could imagine.
Thank you.
There's that wonderful suspense on the upbeat leading to a stamping of the foot on the downbeat, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, it's so much ballet music, isn't it? I noticed you having a little hum, which I think is a musical response to it. And I noticed that at least my head was like going all the time. It's just very, very infectious music, isn't it?
The Mazurka from Act One of the ballet Coppelia by Leo Delibes, performed by the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Sir Neville Mariner. Where did you get your love of ballet from? You mentioned as a small girl being transfixed.
My mother loved ballet, and we lived in Bristol. It was just my mother and my sister and myself at home. She used to take us to the Hippodrome. Most ballet performances, so a Royal Ballet would come, but also at the time there was a Western Theatre Ballet that would come and do the classics. And she bought very, very few records because they were incredibly expensive then. But we had the LP of Coppelia, and I used to play it, and we all, my sister and I, used to dance around the sitting room.
You were actually born in Kenya?
Yes, my father was there working on British East African Airways, and there was a plane crash, and after his death my mother brought us home.
You were only 17 months old when he died, weren't
you? Yes.
That's a pretty dramatic thing to happen. And you didn't really get the opportunity to know him, but did you inherit anything from him, do you think?
Well, the thing is when you lose a parent that young, you never know what is innate to you and what is inherited from them. So it's always a bit of a mystery, but one of the things I treasure, I have them still, is he was a tremendous self-taught man. So he bought in Nairobi the Complete Encyclopedia Britannica, and he would, for pleasure, read a section of it in the evening. This is, of course, pre-television. And I have the book still, and I still, from time to time, consult them. If it's something about the pharaohs, it's pretty good. obviously, science less so. But I think there was a real desire on his part to not be cut off from intellectual change and developments. And he, you know, tried, I think, to keep up with stuff.
And perhaps that curiosity is what you inherited from him too.
It would be lovely to think that. My mother was a fabulous storyteller. Wherever we were, she would look around the room and she would speculate as to the nature of other people, their relationship to each other, what they were doing, how they got there. I mean, she was just naturally a storyteller. And I think he told a good story as well. And he certainly loved non-fiction.
And was there music in your early life?
We weren't a very musical family. We had a record player and we had ballet music, which my mother knew and loved. But my paternal grandfather was a piano teacher. So there's possibly an inheritance through there. And so my mother got me a piano and I had piano lessons from quite young, from about 4 or 5 till O-level.
And I think you used to sing the next piece with him.
Yes, we'd go to church every Sunday. The church was at the top of our road, Christ Church Clifton, and they opened the choir up to girls in, I suppose, the 60s. And I became a chorister with them, which was singing Sunday morning, 10 o'clock, and then finally getting the opportunity to sing at weddings, for which I got paid, which was, to me, a fortune. I mean, you got 10 shillings for a wedding, which was far more than my pocket money. And also, it gave me a real love of the wedding classics, in particular this one, Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring, which I still adore. I think it's the most beautiful, simple, apparently simple piece of music. And then they sign the register. And then they all come out. And then we sing Love Divine and they go down the aisle. It's very, very nice.
There's a kind of inevitability about Bach's music, which moves on harmonically, doesn't it? It just leads you on.
It's so satisfying. There's that sort of predictability, and that when you get to the conclusion, there's such a sense of security that you got where you were planning from the very beginning. It's a journey, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Do you think that the ability to sing at that age is very important for children, because it makes you listen to other people as well as the pleasure you get from taking part?
I think any sort of music's really wonderful for children. I think, I don't know this, but I imagine that it gets into parts of your brain which are not logical, nor in a sense material. So I think looking at art or listening to music or being out in nature all give me that same sense of sort of being transported and yet being very much there.
Jesu bleibet meine Freude, Jesu joy of man's desiring, the final chorale from the Bach Cantata No. 147, performed by the Bach Collegium of Japan with the conductor Masaki Suzuki. Well, I think another love in terms of being out of doors is animals.
Yes, very much so. I wanted, when I was a child, I really wanted to be a vet. And I was constantly, my poor mother, bringing home injured birds and, you know, nestlings and cats and on one occasion a dog which I declared was lost and was clearly not lost. And that relationship which you can have between yourself and an animal which doesn't speak words. My son told me a story about walking in a London park recently, and a man said to his dog as he was walking past him, "Now we've talked about this." Because they're so responsive, you end up having lengthy conversations, especially on disciplinary matters, to your creatures. But literally, you have to get halfway towards them. And I think there's something very transporting about that, that you get out of your consciousness and into the consciousness of a creature that doesn't use words at all. And for a writer, that's revolutionary.
Did you enjoy school?
I enjoyed my primary school quite a lot. And then when I got to secondary school, I changed schools and I didn't fit in so well there. And I found it harder going. And also, I'm very, very poor at maths and arithmetic. I have trouble actually recognising the places of numbers. So I can proofread really quite instinctually, just glancing at the page and the wrong word will jump up. But numbers rather evade me. And that's a real disadvantage.
I find it really extraordinary that somebody who's so passionate about history found it quite difficult then. You got an E at A level, which is quite an achievement.
Yes, that wasn't me, I think. I really think that wasn't me. It was the topic at A level was the wars of the Emperor Justinian. And if you sat down and put your mind to what could be less interesting to a teenage girl who was tremendously interested in the past and tremendously interested in stories and very, very good at English, the wars of the Emperor Justinian are not going to hit the spot. It's about a powerful man thousands of years ago. It's about military history, which is niche, I think. It's about Europe before there's even a nationality of Europe. So you can't even say he invaded Germany because there isn't a Germany at that point. It was just so both foreign and so repellent at the same time that I literally couldn't attend to it. And it was only when I got to university and was introduced by the wonderful Maurice Hutt, later of Sussex University, to social history and more recent history, that I realised here was, to me, the explanation of why everything in the present world is as it is. It was like finding a religion. It was like this answers every single question you've ever asked.
Now, Philippa Gregory, I know you got to know the Pastoral Symphony when you were at school, but it's not the one you've chosen next, is it?
No, that was part of the difficulty of school, that we studied the Pastoral for O-level and in so doing took it apart, put it together again, listen to the different parts of it, listen to it over and over and over, till I literally hated it. And it was only after school and my education that I learned what a wonderful composer Beethoven is and how I came to love this piece.
So what have you chosen?
I've chosen the Symphony No. 5 in C minor, the second movement.
Thank you.
The Andante con moto from the Beethoven Symphony No. 5 in C minor, played by the Royal Northern Sinfonia, conducted by Thomas Zettmeyer. Philippa Gregory, after school you went into journalism. What sort of things were you covering?
Oh, I was a local newspaper journalist. I remember my first headline, I worked on the Portsmouth Evening News, and my first front page was a story about somebody's prize-winning marrow. I mean, I was literally the junior journalist. And I worked my way up to the glorious position of head of a district office, where I was doing everything that happened there. So that included fires and traffic accidents, and also a stint in court, and also a stint in council meetings, which was a wonderful education in terms of what's going on locally and what matters to people locally. And I did my apprenticeship, and then I realised that I should really all along have been at university. And because I was fortunately near, geographically near to the University of Sussex at Brighton, and they were very, very open at the time to returning students and older students. And so I got in, even with my disastrous A-levels, on the basis that I had now learned the errors of my ways and was capable of learning something. And there fell in love with history. It was, yes, a revelation.
And it was there really that, as you mentioned earlier, you met someone who was teaching, who was able to turn the key in the door, as it were.
Absolutely. It was an extraordinary moment. I went to study English literature. I was reading novels voraciously. So I went to study English literature, and the University of Sussex had at that time a rule that you had to do two other humanities in your first year. And so I did philosophy, which was wonderfully confusing and completely bewildered me. And then I did this introduction to history course with a historian of the French Revolution. So it wasn't anything that actually applied directly to my life, but it just seemed to me that if you understand what happened before, you can understand the now, and you can even have a stab at saying what's going to happen next. And that was a question, I think, because of being a child in circumstances that were not of my choosing. Most children are. But I had a sense of my mother, of a life that she had lost. So the idea of optional different pasts was very, very vivid to me.
Sounds as though this was quite an adventure, as though you were back in your father's Encyclopaedia Britannica, finding out things about the world.
Absolutely. And history at Sussex University was very much in those days focused on left-wing radical explanations and upon working-class history. And my father was a man from the working classes and my mother was not. So I had this real sense of understanding a part of my own history, which I'd never looked at before.
A change of musical tack now.
Oh, yes, so lovely. This is All That Jazz from Chicago, which I loved when I first heard. I mean, who can't love it?
We paint the town and all that jazz. I'm gonna rouge my knees and pull my stockings down and all that jazz. Start the car, I know a whoopee spot where the gin is cold but the piano's hot. It's just a noisy hall where there's a nightly brawl and all of that jazz. Oh, stick your hair and wear your buckle shoes. And all that jazz, I hear that Father Dip is gonna blow the blues. And all that jazz, hold on, hon, we're gonna bunny hug. I bought some aspirin down at United Drug. Apart and want a brand new start to do a that a jazz.
Oh, you're gonna see a sheep, a shimmy shake.
Oh, and all that jazz.
Oh, Yeah, I'm afraid so, kiddo.
Oh, Fred.
Yeah.
Nobody walks out on me.
Gorgeous, isn't it?
You know, Philippa Gregory, the root of an awful lot of music is the bass. Mm. And there, it's often something very simple that sparks such a wonderful idea. So we've got the brass just going boom, 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 boom. And yet from that, somebody creates what we've just heard.
Absolutely. And how it just builds up and up and up and like more and more comes in.
All That Jazz from the original 1975 Broadway cast recording of Chicago with Cheetah Rivera in the lead role. Philippa, you completed your first novel, Wideacre, in 1987 while studying for your PhD. What compelled you at that time to start writing fiction?
Oh, well, that came out of the PhD in a rather extraordinary way, that after Sussex University, I went back to journalism for a year while I figured out what I wanted to do. And then I realised again that what I really wanted to do was to answer the vexed question to me, which is, why are women in movies, books, musicals, anything, so incredibly stupid as to always walk into danger? So in the 18th century novel, the heroine is told that there is a terrible fiend going down the village street and on no account to go out, and she bars her door and she puts herself inside and she draws the curtains, and then just as she's going to bed, she glances out of the window and sees a full moon and goes like, how lovely it would be to walk in the garden. And so she goes out, walks in the garden, and someone comes through the gate and kidnaps her. And that happens again and again. It's literally the start of all the Gothic novels and so much popular entertainment. And I thought that I would be doing women a service everywhere if I traced this story to its root, and I thought its root would be in the 18th century novels, but then found to my disappointment that there was no helpful bestseller chart in the 18th century which would guide me. But the nearest I could get to it would be to look at the records of the 18th century but borrowing libraries, the ones that occur in Jane Austen all the time, the ones where everybody goes to get the popular novels. So I went all around the country on this really devoted quest and scooped up 18th century library catalogues. Then I cross-compared them to see which were the most borrowed novels, which were the most stocked novels. And then I read all of them, 200 18th century novels, and then I cross-compared all of their stories with the help of a computer program, which gave me in the end 6 or 7 plots which occurred everywhere. And then when I'd finished my PhD, which took me 4 years, not surprising, what I had just done accidentally was an apprenticeship in novel writing. So I set about my own novel, which is indeed very Gothic, set in the 18th century, about a woman who cannot inherit her family estate and goes about destroying the true heirs in order to get it.
Did you have at that time, and do you still have, rules about blending historical fact and imagination in your work?
No, I never had rules until people said to me, you're breaking them. And then, and then I went, I better look into this rules business. What I find now is there is a constant, in a sense, dialogue in my own mind with every novel as to what is the story I'm going to tell. So if I'm writing about, say, Elizabeth I, and everybody knows almost everything about Elizabeth I, I would concentrate on the bits that we don't know about, for instance, the relationship with Robert Dudley. So I wrote a book called The Virgin's Lover, which really explores the bits that we don't know in that story, the fate of Robert Dudley's wife, for instance. But if I'm writing a book about someone who doesn't occur in history really at all, very much, like, for instance, Jane Boleyn in The Boleyn Traitor, the new book, where she's there at these incredibly important events, and we know she's there, sometimes we even know what she's wearing, but we never know what she's thinking.
That's where you come in.
That's where I come in. That's why it's a novel, because it's got to be fiction, because there is no record of her thinking. We don't have, we have only one letter from her.
How much research do you end up doing? And do you like to visit places to get a feel of them?
I absolutely make that a rule. And that's when you get this wonderful sense. Well, the challenge in historical fiction for me is not so much the research, which is very, very accessible, more accessible now than it's ever been, because so many libraries are completely digitised. But what you can't capture from a book is the feel of the place, or the colour of the earth, or the mood that it gives you, and that's incredibly evocative.
The late great Hilary Mantel, who also wrote about Tudor Court and Thomas Cromwell,
she did a bit, yeah,
talked about feeling the presence of ghosts around her. Does that ever ring true for you?
Well, we talked about it together, yes. We were both of us very intuitive. I think for us the spirit of the place is always present, and the spirit of the people we're writing about, it is always at our shoulders. Of course, she and I both recognise that this is a work of imagination, so we are imagining these presences, but at the same time they seemed very real to us, and I think she would go so far as to say that she felt them as a real presence, and sometimes I do.
A sublime piece of music next from Mozart, the famous trio Soave sia il vento from Così fan tutte.
When I first heard it, I hadn't ever been to an opera, so I heard it in a selection of famous songs, and I thought it was so beautiful and so moving, and only afterwards did I realise that it's a song, a very yearning song, but in a completely absurd opera. the libretto's ridiculous, but the emotion and the lyricism of the music, I mean, just completely excels any of the words. So beautiful.
I love the way Mozart conjures up the lapping of the waves in the strings. Da, 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 da. And then those three voices singing the same words. Soave sia il vento, may the wind be gentle, from Mozart's Così fan tutti, sung by Mia Persson, Christine Rice and Bryn Terfel. The Scottish Chamber Orchestra conducted by Charles McCarris. 2.5 minutes of pure gold.
Yes, and that's, we were talking before we went into it about the idea of sort of a presence, like I feel something there. I couldn't tell you what I'm feeling, but it's incredibly evocative, isn't it? That there's, you know, when it finished, we were both very quiet. There's something has come into the room in a really, really beautiful way.
The Other Boleyn Girl came out in 2001. It was quite a turning point, I imagine. Huge exposure for that.
Yes, it was extraordinary. I thought that it would be very, very big. But it started very small. It was published first in paperback, and extraordinarily the paperback was so successful that they then brought out the hardback after the paperback for people who wanted a copy in their libraries. And still, it's the book that I am most asked about today, even still. I mean, it had this afterlife of, as you said, the television series, and then the Hollywood world of film and publicity, which was extraordinary.
Why do you think, if you can put your finger on it, you said you knew, you thought it was going to be big. Why? What is it about the story that captured the imagination?
I first discovered the existence of Mary Boleyn. I was sitting in the London Library, not very far from here, and I was reading books on Tudor piracy. So I was reading the manifests of Tudor ships, and I came across a ship being launched, and Henry VIII launched it himself after a refit, and it was called Mary Boleyn. And I went, that's wrong. It should be Anne or her mother, Elizabeth. And in the library, so close as I were to all of the books, I just pulled out a very, very, very big who's who in the Tudor court, looked up Mary Boleyn and discovered the sister to Anne, who was Henry's lover before he met Anne. I've never heard of her. And I went, this is an extraordinary story. So you've got sibling rivalry there, and that Mary probably had a boy who would have solved all of Henry's problems if he had married her on the death of her husband rather than pursuing Anne. So you have there, it's going to be a fabulous historical novel. You've got everything. You've got sex, you've got jealousy, you've got rivalry, you've got the road that should have been taken that wasn't taken, you've got what-if history, as well as a whole chunk of fantastic history. Throw in the Reformation and, you know, the Boleyn upward rise, throw in the middle classes, throw in everything else that's happening. The Renaissance is happening as well. I knew it was going to be a fantastically enjoyable book to write, and I thought it would be therefore a fantastically enjoyable book to read, and it did transform my career.
No green sleeves today.
No.
Henry VIII actually never wrote it, but we often say he did. It's interesting how this king, with his six wives, has managed to attain a certain status in our collective imagination. What do you think of him now? Do you think of the later character, or do you think of him as the earlier person who was rather dashing?
I think if you're a good historian, then you have the ability to hold all the life in your mind at once. So I think it's possible to think of him in his multiplicity of years and roles and life. But I think what's really, really important, especially in the world we live in today, is that we stop teaching in our schools Henry VIII, the rather jolly husband of six women, isn't that kind of eccentric and quaint and amusing. And we start being really aware that what we're talking about is a serial killer who kills more than his wives. He kills his friends and his colleagues as well. And he deliberately executes two wives and terribly neglects others. What we're talking about is a tyrant. And through the years that I've been writing about him, I've become clearer and clearer that this is not just a problem about Henry, it's a problem about how we perceive men in the modern world. Around the world today, we have elected tyrants to rule countries, and we will see what power does for them. Mm-hmm. And what we know from history is that it is corrupting.
A song now, That's All. What made you come to this?
I think this is one of the greatest love songs. I love the lyrics. I think they're beguilingly simple. And the tune itself is very, very simple. So it's like a Trojan horse. There's much more in it than you think when you first look at it.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone, that's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore for now and evermore. That's all, that's all. Wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore for now and evermore. That's all, that's all.
Nat King Cole singing That's All by Bob Hames. Is it the romantic in you, Philippa, that responds to that?
I think it is. While I was listening to it, I was wondering if you were sitting there hating it.
No.
And if it was, like, terribly sentimental. But I do find it very, very romantic. And I really like paradoxical injunctions, particularly in art. So I think, you know, I'm offering you nothing but eternal love. It's, like, really rather a charming proposal.
And of course, it provides a contrast for you for the world you have often lived in and the lack of romantic love that surrounded so many women at court.
Well, it's a period before love is regarded as a reasonable motive to do anything, and therefore everybody expects their marriage to be arranged, and almost no elite women marry their choice until they're widowed, which is why it's so great to be a medieval widow, because hopefully you get a share of your husband's former fortune, which you probably earned anyway, and at last you get the chance to marry somebody that you want. So, of course, you don't get a lot of happily married, loving medieval wives. But what you do get is some really, really successful business arrangements.
Tell me a bit about Elizabeth Woodville.
She is a widow who marries the man of her choice. It happens that the man of her choice is Edward IV, King of England. And we know that they marry, certainly for love on his side, that they meet as he's recruiting men to go and fight in the Wars of the Roses. And they marry on his return from the battle. So it's 6 weeks later. It's on a May Day morning, which is the great day of misrule and love. And people subsequently say that she enchanted him with the help of her mother, who is a recognised witch. So she's she's spot on for one of my heroines. I mean, she is famously beautiful. She is working independently. And she's descended from the water goddess Melusina. I mean, what can I say? She's right up my street. And then she marries this incredibly eligible, handsome man who has just fought his way to the throne of England, and they have dozens of children together. Of course, she is the mother of the princes in the Tower, which is one of the greatest mysteries that history still holds.
You mentioned witchcraft, and of course the Plantagenet court that you were writing about introduces elements of magical thinking, of witchcraft, spirits. How much are you trying to explore the idea that people in the past did actually see the world very differently to us?
I don't think you can dream of writing history unless you park the modern scientific knowledge at the door and look at the world as much as they did, as much as you can. If you were a medieval person, you genuinely thought that disease was spread by fogs, miasma, emanations from the ground. There's no other way of explaining it. And so people cling to that as an explanation. They try and guard against it. And of course, when you have no idea of how to prevent disease, you're of course driven towards coincidences and superstition. So people have faith in magical cures and magical interventions and in spells, and they use them as prayers. So they have a great deal of faith also in prayer. In my study at home, I have a huge wall of books on history. I have a huge wall of books on women's history, on feminism, which is my greatest pursuit. And then I have a relatively small but a wall of books on magic. And you can literally look up, even today, in a modern published book, a spell for curing heartbreak or the herbs to bring on, you know, tears.
With all your fascination for past royalty, I was interested to read that you're something of a Republican.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's not something I'm ever going to go on a demonstration about. I just don't think it's really appropriate in the modern world, and I object if it's particularly expensive. Having said that, I've attended the Queen's Reading Room celebrations, and I've judged the Queen's Commonwealth Prize of Literature, and what Queen Camilla has done for reading and for literature and for literacy in this country is really, really significant. It's nothing personal. Mm. It's not about them personally. But I just don't know that in a mature democracy we need a royal family.
Chopin now. This music is by, in a way, the great composer of piano music. What does it say to you?
It speaks to me at a number of levels. I can just about play it, but not very well. And I first heard it and loved it when I saw Margot Fonteyn on a black and white television dancing to the Nocturne. I think Nureyev was her partner. And I can remember looking at it and listening to music and thinking, I was not very old at all. I was about 10 or 11, I think. I remember thinking, that's perfection. I have just seen something perfect.
Thank you.
The second of Chopin's three nocturnes for piano, Opus 9, performed by Vladimir Ashkenazy. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the historical novelist Philippa Gregory. In recent years, Philippa, you've also written non-fiction about normal women. That's your title. What do you mean by normal?
What I wanted to do was I wanted to write a history about the vast majority of women, not the queens, not the elite, not even the saints and the particularly famous one. I wanted to write a history of the women of England, looking at the ones that we don't know about. But I didn't want it to be called ordinary women, because they're not ordinary at all. They are women who battle against the law, against the prejudices of their time, against the wall of male privilege and male dominance, and they constantly are seeking the opportunity to further themselves as individuals and sometimes to further other women as well, and certainly to protect and defend their families. So it couldn't be ordinary women. But I also wanted to not say this is exceptional women, because this is what normal women do every day. So I called it Normal Women, 900 Years of Making History. And these are the women that engaged in the trades and engaged in the arts and engaged in farming and mining and heavy industries and made the economy move from the terrific poverty of the immediate doomsday years into a country of increasing prosperity, enduring the shocks of things like plague and civil war, and then right up to the present day.
Where did you look for glimpses of them?
Well, the medieval world only really records medieval women when they're doing something that the record keepers don't like. So some of the stuff is drawn from criminal records. Some of the stuff is drawn from landowning records, that you get quite a good picture of a woman's increasing wealth when you see that she's paying more rent or that she's charging rent. So there are some legal documents where these women occur, but mostly it's when men of power and authority are complaining about them. So you get a lot of documents about women's unrest and women rioting, especially in the 18th century, because the Justice of the Peace are saying that there was a food riot because the people here are starving, and it was all women.
This is all a long way from the history that you learnt as a child, the Justinian Wars.
Yes. So,
do you think what is now considered worthy of historical inquiry has changed in the last decades? I mean, far more interest in social history, domestic lives.
Absolutely. And I think the whole idea of diversity and inclusion has spilled over to an idea that the history of everybody is of interest, and that it's not just the history of the rulers, it's not just the history of kings, it's not just the history of military generals, that what people are doing is actually what history is about.
We were saying earlier that curiosity is an essential part, and I'm wondering, bearing that in mind, what you made of Philip Glass's opera Satyagraha, which you've chosen next.
Oh, well, this was an eye-opener to me. I went to it because I have a stepson who's interested in modern music, and I said, I will take you, it's on at the ENO. And I didn't expect to enjoy it at all, and I absolutely loved it. And more than anything else, I learned about Gandhi's early life in apartheid South Africa. And, I mean, it was extraordinary to me to go to an opera with the hope that I would like it and learn a whole load of history, which is extraordinarily interesting, which I didn't know at all.
And what did you make of the music?
I really liked it. And what I thought was so wonderful about it, this is the Laughing Song, and the ENO staged it as a gentleman's club, and there were the male chorus were all seated in sort of big club chairs with their newspapers, and they were laughing at, you know, Gandhi's heroic attempt to alleviate the poverty of the South African poor. And it's the very sound of racist patriarchy.
Thank you.
Rhythmic repetition is a very vital part of that. Did that get inside your head?
Oh, yes. And also, after a little while, it starts sounding like the wheels of the buses and the transport, and you literally see the sort of the railways of South Africa and the expansion of all of that. But just that extraordinary repeated laughter, it's just such a powerful thing.
Part of Confrontation and Rescue from Act Two of Philip Glass's opera Satyagraha, performed by the New York City Opera and Orchestra, conducted by Christopher Keene. There's been an important evaluation, Philip, in recent decades of the great men of history, as it were, in quotes. Your school in Bristol was founded by Edward Colston. How was he presented when you were a student there?
I mean, interestingly, I was a student there before there was any question of pulling the statue down, before there was really much question about where slavery money came from, certainly that I heard of. So we would do Commemoration Day and we would celebrate Edward Colston as the person who had produced the money which had founded our school, and we would all wear bronze chrysanthemums because that was his favourite flower, apparently, and we would all go to the cathedral, have the commemoration service, and then go down to his statue in Bristol city centre and put our chrysanthemums on the statue, and then we'd have a half day off, and that was all very jolly. And then in very nearly, I think, my final year at school, one of the priests at the cathedral did a sermon in which he said, "Have you ever thought where the money came from?" And none of us ever had. And I mean, that's a real example of fantastic history in practice. And it was really striking to me that I won a scholarship at the school. So slavery money very directly benefited me, and in that it paid for my education. It stayed with me as a thought for a long, long time, and ultimately I wrote a novel called A Respectable Trade, which was an award-winning BBC Sunday night drama about slavery, specifically in Bristol. And all of a sudden, that conversation happened all over again, and I was in Bristol talking to people who were still then denying that Bristol had been a fabulously successful slaving port, and that the extraordinarily beautiful buildings of Clifton and Park Street and all of that was on slavery money.
It's quite a sobering thing to come to terms with. What did you think when you saw his statue coming down?
I thought it was absolutely high time, and that if the council had had any sense, they would have listened to the people who had complained about it for so long before. I then think, what do you do with these statues? There's a statue park in Moscow where they have discredited tyrant statues, and they're lying on their backs, and they're beautifully neglected, growing over with ivy and creepers. And it's a real way of understanding that they are no longer respected and regarded and honoured, but it's not that they disappear. I think it's terribly important when you take a statue down that you acknowledge why you've taken it down and why it was there for so long as well. I think the idea that you just bundle it off into a shed and hope that everyone forgets about it, that's a profoundly unhistorical thing to do. It's as historical an act to take it down as it was to put it up.
You wrote A Respectable Trade and went to the Gambia, didn't you? But you also ended up setting up a charity. How did that begin?
It's one of the accidental really delights of my life. I went to the Gambia to research for A Respectable Trade, and I went just out of interest to a school because I was writing a newspaper piece about, is it possible to do ethical tourism? So I went to a school and I met the school teacher there, whose name was Ismaila Cisse. This is nearly 35 years ago. And he said, would I consider giving him the money to dig a well to put in the school yard, which was an acre of dust. And he said if they could have a well to irrigate the dust, then they would be able to grow food crops there, which the children could eat as a supplement to the rice that they were given by the World Health Organization at their lunchtime. and they would be able to drink water from the well. And at the moment, they had to carry it from the village on their heads in buckets every morning if they wanted to drink at school during the day. And I was rather taken aback. And I said, how much money are we talking about here? And he said, £250. And I went, that's a deal. That's a great piece of work for £250. And then I got a fax from him, and he said, thank you very much. We've dug the well. It's on stream. We are now growing the garden, and we're going to grow nut trees around the school garden as well. And we expect it to be self-sufficient very, very soon. Really, really thrilled about it. And the school next door would like a well also, if you would send £250 for that. And I went, I tell you what, I will. That's just brilliant. So I sent another £250, and then I wrote about it and I started raising money for them. And I never raised anything like what I sent. And I said I will do it until I put a well in every primary school in the Gambia, because there are only 250, so it's not impossible. And I've achieved that. I've done that.
That's a wonderful story. Gilbert and Sullivan next.
What a jump. I went to Iolanthe by the English National Opera, and I have never laughed so much in a theatre to this song in particular.
If you go in, you're sure to win. Yours will be the charming maiden. Be your lord, the ancient soul. Fate has never won her name.
Never, 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 fate has never won her lady. Every journey has an end, when at the worst affairs will mend. Dark the dawn when day is nigh, hustle your horse and don't say die.
Such a prize is not worth a mare of lady. Be so kind to bear in mind, fate hath never won fair lady.
Never, 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 fate hath never won fair lady.
While the sun shines, make your hay. Where a will is, there's a way. Near the lion in his lair, none but the brave deserve the fair.
Start, though I fear the prospect shady, much I'd spend to gain my end. Fate hath never won fair lady.
Never, 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 fate hath never won fair lady.
Nothing venture, nothing win. Blood is thick, but water's thin. In for a penny, in for a pound, it's love that makes the world go round.
Nothing venture, nothing win. Blood is thick, but water's thin. In for a penny, in for a pound, it's love that makes the world go round.
It's just so happy, isn't it?
It is. If you go in, you're sure to win, from Gilbert and Sullivan's Iolanthe. In that vintage doily cart performance, we heard Thomas Round, Donald Adams and John Reed with the new London Orchestra conducted by Isidore Godfrey. Your most current novel, Philippa, is set back in the Tudor court. As we said, Boleyn Traitor, about Lady Rochford and Boleyn's sister-in-law. It's been more than a decade since you wrote about the Tudors. Do you feel you had some unfinished business?
I did, rather, because Jane Boleyn, born Jane Parker, has had a very unfair treatment by historians over the years. So to the Victorian historians, she was a bad wife. She failed to save George Boleyn from either being inveigled into trouble by his sister or from Henry's executioner's axe. But she's not listed as a witness at their trial, so there's no reason to believe that she helped towards the evidence which killed them. Then you come on to the modern day, And some historians like to think that she was complicit in the death of Anne Boleyn for adultery. However, that's not really what's interesting about her. What's interesting about her is how when Anne Boleyn is beheaded and George is beheaded, and Jane is therefore stripped of all her wealth and all her fortune and all her positions as the wife of a traitor and the sister-in-law to a traitorous queen, how is it that the very next reign, there's Jane Seymour and there's Jane Boleyn first in line behind her as her senior lady-in-waiting. Jane Seymour dies. Who's the next lady-in-waiting up for Anne of Cleves? Jane Boleyn. Anne of Cleves is divorced. Who's next lady-in-waiting up in line for Catherine Howard? It's Jane Boleyn again. And you go, somebody is keeping this woman in power and is promoting her, and somebody gets a law passed in the House of Parliament that she gets a fantastic deal on her widow's dower. And the only person who had the power and influence to do that is Thomas Cromwell. And so I think, I'm pretty sure, that she becomes a spy for Thomas Cromwell. He had a big spy network in the country, in Europe and in court, and I think she's one of his spies.
You've been writing for nearly 40 years. Does history continue to inspire you? Are you looking ahead?
Oh, yes. I am currently working on the next novel. And once again, I am right in the medieval world of mystery and magic. And it never, never ceases to enchant me.
When you're not there, Philip, you're at home in the Leicestershire countryside. And are you able to indulge that childhood love of animals?
Oh, yes, very much so. I have an absolutely adored companion who is a Irish red setter, who is very, very beautiful and I think extremely intelligent. Certainly she gets her own way. And I ride a couple of times a week on a borrowed horse, and I also house and release rescued owls. So I have a rich animal kingdom around me.
And the piano still keeping you going?
The piano is still keeping me going, and I'm still dancing in my kitchen to the mazurka and some of these other lovely pieces of music.
Well, it might be nice to finish with some piano music then. What do you suggest?
Oh, well, this is something that I can play. It's a ragtime waltz, which I think is such an unusual combination. It's the only one I know. It's by Scott Joplin. It's called the Bethina Waltz.
Thank you. Scott Joplin's Bethina Waltz for piano, performed by William Albright, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the historical novelist Philippa Gregory. The programme was produced by Katie Hickman. Next week, Michael's guest will be the architect and designer Asif Khan.
Nemorino is in love with Adina, but his boastful rival Belcore has other plans. In desperation, Nemorino buys a love potion to win Adina's heart, but it turns out to be cheap red wine. Join us for Donizetti's sparkling romantic comedy, The Elixir of Love. Opera on Three. Listen now on BBC Sound.
Now it's time to join Sarah Moore-Peach for this week's edition of Music Map, which explores one of Franz Liszt's most popular works, the Hungarian Rhapsody No. 2.
Welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, where we take a piece of classical music as our endpoint and plot a journey towards it, locating it within a landscape of musical connections. This is today's destination piece, Franz Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody No. 2 for solo piano, written in 1851. And this, the most famous of his 19 rhapsodies, sits within a rich seam of classical music inspired by folk styles. So let's begin our playlist today there, with Georges Bizet whipping up a rustic line dance from the south of France.